Well, I think we can lead ourselves in the serenity prayer, shall we? Okay, a moment of silence, please, followed by this serenity prayer.
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
And you don't have to be perfect to serve. That's nice, too. I learned how to make mistakes here and that it was okay. So today we have Mark, who's going to be our speaker. He was here at Baton Rouge meetings when I first wandered in, and I've learned a lot from his example of service and recovery. He was actually the Baton Rouge AIS chairperson in 2009, and he invited me to the chair-elect position. And so for that, I thank you, Mark. But David James is actually going to introduce him to us today as our speaker. So please welcome David James.
Thank you, Angela, and thank you very much for your service. We all saw it here today, but there's a lot that you have done for this organization behind the scenes, and thank you for that. She also mentioned a lot of names, and that's the current folks that keep the lights on for us. When I got here in 2001, I had no recollection or no understanding of what it took for a meeting to be there. There's a room, there's lights, there's chairs, it's magic, help me, fix me, do it now. I would like to back up and say that my name is David James, and I'm a very grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon Family Groups. My home group is Just for Today Family Group. We met this morning at 9 o'clock at LSU. They seem to have meetings whether I'm there or not, but I do try to keep my meeting commitment there. There's a lot of emotion in my heart. It's pretty full today. Many of you were here when I got here, and you didn't throw me out. I talk about the time, the early days, when I argued with the happy people about why you were wrong and how we needed to do this different. And I know now, looking back, that all you wonderful people were just kind of smiling, thinking, my God, will he ever shut up, you know? And then we'll talk about what the staff or whatever. I did not get what I came here thinking I would get. You've heard it before. I've gotten so much more. There were some prices to be paid. Mark, I promise I'm going to introduce you in a minute. Seriously, you know, it began as showing up at a meeting, and then it was fellowship, and then it was steps, and then it was traditions, and now it's a way of life. I'm very blessed that of all the people that live in my household, Maggie and I, we're all in recovery, and that is that's a real blessing. When I got here, Mark was an old timer then. He must be a really old timer now. And everybody likes Mark. You know, when I first got here, my wife delineated between the Marks. You know, cute Mark. And it's like, really, Maggie, come on. Mark is going to tell you his own story. I will tell one little funny that I think is... I'm honored that sometimes we talk on the phone and he'll call me, and he's called me before and says, yeah, it's not going so well, this, that, and the other. I'm traveling. It's like, where are you? Hawaii? It's like, okay. Okay. You want to have trouble, go to Hawaii and meet, you know, with your family and do it there. That kind of beats Podunk, Louisiana, I guess. But, you know, everybody in the room makes a difference. We all get a seat at the table. Mark was here holding the torch for me. And that's what we try to do. We just try to pass it on. Nobody owns this stuff. Nobody has it by the tail. We just all do the best we can. Mark, you're quite an ambassador for Al-Anon. You've always stepped up. A meeting will not go with deer in the headlights silence without you speaking up and speaking on the topic. I admire that. You get in, you get out. Not quite as verbose as me sometimes, but I just admire you, and I'm glad to call you friend. I'd like for you to come up here and share your story with our family. Mark Wilson. Mark W. Wilson. Whoopsie.
My name is Mark Wilson. I am an alumni.
Thank you, Mark.
And I don't care if anybody can look me up in the phone book and call me. For sure, a lot of you out there.
Yeah.
It's probably the most, not probably, it's the most important thing I've done with my life. And when I came in, I felt like a lot of people did. This was a program for losers. Mm-hmm. And the things had gotten so bad that I had to go to Al-Anon. Oh my God. And it's funny because I took one of my friends who was having a tough time, and that was his perception too. Mm-hmm. So I know that the newcomers out there are not going to be impressed with the time I've been out on. I mean, as soon as I'm slow, I didn't get it. I have to. But I started coming in 1988, and I went regularly since that time, although it got a lot more serious in 1990, thanks to a very special woman. And yeah, you know, I really don't have a very interesting story. It's pretty boring, really. When I was growing up, there was a lot of shouting and hysterics. But, you know, everything seemed to move along. I was always in school and had everything I needed. I went to some terrific schools. I feel very blessed now. Although I didn't when I got here. I felt like I was a victim. And I tried through my own force of will to bring about changes I knew to be made in myself. I knew I shouldn't be so angry or resentful. I knew I should be able to sleep at night. I knew I should be able to drive like a normal person on the freeway. And I was having trouble with all those things when I got here. You know, what I want to do is tell a joke first. The psychiatrist joke, which you'll see is relevant later on, but there was these two psychiatrists and they worked in this building, high-rise building, and a tall psychiatrist and a short psychiatrist, and every day they would get on the elevator together, and the tall guy would get off on the floor before the short guy did, and every day before he did that, he'd spit on the head of the short psychiatrist, and the short psychiatrist would just calmly wipe the spit off his head and get off on his floor. Now there was a guy who was riding up the elevator, and he's watching this go on, and he's like, "What is going on?" So finally, he works up with courage when he asks the guy, short guy, "Why is that guy spitting your head every day?" He said, "I don't know, that's his problem." And I wish I had that kind of serenity all the time. But, you know, I started realizing, I came in as identify myself as an adult child of alcoholic because I wasn't involved with active alcoholics other than my mother. I knew I was having some problems because every girlfriend I had, they seemed to get crazier and crazier, each one. And But they all seem to be affected by alcoholism. There's alcoholics, or most of them are from families of alcoholics. And I started to realize there's a pattern there. And I started making the connection with, you know, growing up with alcoholism, and I started getting into the adult child literature, and that's why I came to meetings at first. So at some point I started to think, I'm going to get smarter about this. So the next girlfriend I had, I said, well, are your parents alcoholic? And she said, no. I was like, God, thank God. And later on I was talking to her and said, you know, my brother's alcoholic. And I thought, I can't beat it. And but I did meet a certain woman who, I don't even know if she's an alcoholic or not. But when she drank, her personality changed. And when she drank, my personality changed. And instead of this tightly wrapped, what I thought was tightly wrapped, controlled person, I started doing things I didn't really think were not good. You know, I started yelling and screaming and kicking stuff, and the odd thing is she seemed to like that. She seemed to show that I cared. But, you know, it's just the usual story. You know, she moved 5.5 hours away, and I drove up there one day to surprise her, which meant, some of you might know, I was checking up on her. But and she wasn't there, and I started crying, and her roommate was there, and we were crying. And I drove 5.5 hours back, and then she got home from where she was doing, and she drove 5.5 hours down to see me again. And so I was telling the story to some normal people. They said, oh, how romantic. that was what I thought about it. But she, you know, I was in Al-Anon at the time. That was the thing that was a big eye-opener to me. And I got in my car one day to go look for her in Jacksonville, Florida, which is a big city. And I didn't even know she went out to any bars. I didn't even know what I was doing, but I couldn't help myself. I think that's when I had my first real first step moment, you know, because up at that point, I think I had been, not consciously, but saying that, taking the first step, saying that she was powerless over alcohol and my life was unmanageable. But when I got in that car, I couldn't stop myself. I realized I was one that was out of control. I was powerless over alcohol. And now I drove back after a short period of time. And if you'd called me at that time and told me what you were going to do, I said, no, don't do that. That's crazy. But I couldn't help myself. And I was doing a lot of things that I felt like my life was really out of control. I couldn't help myself. And I had done the steps by myself without a sponsor. And, you know, I think it did help a little bit. I gained some more insights into my behavior. But it didn't fundamentally change the way I was doing things. And so I got a sponsor, and I was far from perfect. You know, when I came in, I was not a good Al-Anon. I wanted you all to see what the real issues were. And I brought in my outside literature, and I tried to do everything to control the meeting that I could. And luckily, people tolerated me long enough there to where I became teachable. And alcoholism has a way of making unreasonable people reasonable. And that's what happened to me. You know, sometimes I think I have original thoughts, but nothing I say up here is original. Everything is taken from this program, cribbed from speakers. I really love Al-Anon speakers. It's been a very important part of my recovery. I listen to them constantly when I was in the car. It was like a meeting in the car, and I listened to it at night when I couldn't fall asleep. But anyway, what else? Lots of things happened. I mean, I started with a sponsor, and I started getting an idea of what was going on. And I remember one time I was always, in my mind, I was always, should I stay or should I go? That was the obsession I had with this girlfriend. And, my sponsor suggested that I just show up, and be the best boyfriend I could be, and not, I was under assignment not to break up or get back together with her again. I see now what he was doing was turning that relationship over to my higher power. It sounds so simple, and it is very simple. So I was told it's a simple program for complicated people, but to not interfere, to not control, to not do those things, was very scary. I mean, I'm talking about dry heave fear, kind of scary, and. I certainly didn't do it perfectly. I wrote her a letter. I sent her a card, I think. I forget what was in the card. And it was break up or not break up, whatever. And I sent it, and then I sent it back. Because I told my sponsor, I didn't actually tell her anything, but I put in the card, try to get around what she was telling me. So then I tried to get back from the mailman. And, they don't do that. It's like a crime or something. But I remember one time I broke up with her. This is before I went to Spain. I broke up with her, and I realized it was a terrible mistake, and I couldn't get a hold of her. She was living in some sort of dormitory. And, that was before cell phones. And, it's when we had to call and the phone rings. Some of you remember the phone ring in the lobby and someone just happy walking by and answer it. And say, well, so-and-so there. And they'd say, well, no. Shout her name, down the hall, you hear it. So I couldn't get over, so I sent her a five-page letter, I think it was, typed, overnight mail, canceling my breakup or. And then I think I sent her another one the next day, I'm not sure, but canceling the first letter. That's what happens when I run my life. Chased after the mail carrier and sent over any letters. I suppose that's romantic to some people, but. I really tried letting go of what was happening with her, and it did not go well. She did not like it. I think anytime you change the way you behave with somebody in a relationship, it's scary. And I was under orders from my sponsor not to explain to her. I learned that's one of my character defects, explaining. I think now, how was I going to explain it to her? Is this for your own good? Whatever. About 6 months later, we were talking, and she said, Mark, do you love me? And for the first time in a very long time, I told the truth. I said, I don't know. And she said, that's not good enough, I'm leaving. So she left me. That was the answer to my question. She was there, should I go? It wasn't what I wanted it to be. It didn't come the way I expected to. But I knew in my heart it was the right thing. And for once, I hadn't interfered with that process to the best of my ability. And I haven't seen her since. That was many years ago. I hope she's doing well. I certainly got better. Today, I can sleep at night most nights. And, I didn't have any idea of a higher power when I got here. I didn't believe in God. I didn't want anybody to talk to me about God. It pissed me off. didn't like the Lord's Prayer. I wouldn't say it. I didn't say it for 2 years after I got here. I thought it was a great thing, and I heard a speaker say he didn't say it for 7 years after he got here. But today I'm like, you know, if that prayer helps me keep my sanity train, I'm going to say it. I'm going to do whatever it takes. Because I do not want to go back to feeling the way I was feeling when I got here. Never. I really don't want to do it, but I'm less than perfect. I think that's one of the defining characteristics of my illness. It's my own inability to tolerate my own imperfections, and everything is black and white for me. Dealing with the in-between is what really hangs me up. My goal now is to live in what's been called the fourth dimension of existence, where I intuitively know that I have a situation that used to baffle me. Yeah. Where I'm in a spiritual mode where things just flow. Not everything works out the way it's supposed to, but it has a flow to it where it's different than the way I used to do it when I used to try and figure everything out. And to me, steps 1, 2, and 3 happened to me while I was here by coming to meetings and getting sponsored. They happened to me. You know, I came to believe the power greater than myself. For me, I thought it was such a big deal, you know. But I remember seeing in Gainesville, Florida, where I got a lot of my recovery from, there was no Al-Anon meeting on Friday night. And I, at that point, I had to go to a meeting every day or I just was totally crazy. And I couldn't function. And on Friday nights, there was an open-A speaker meeting, you know, but that was back when everybody smoked, and that room was just like, it was, you couldn't see the other end hardly. Yeah. But I went there because I was too crazy to do anything else. So I'd sit in the meeting as long as I could, and I'd run outside and get fresh air and breathe, and then run back in there. But there was a speaker there, I can't remember his name. He was an AA speaker, and he had this African statuette. It was thin, you know, once it's all face. The statue was called Lulabelle. And he said Lulabelle was his higher power because he didn't have to drink. Lulabelle didn't have to drink. And so I thought, you know, it doesn't have to be this really complicated thing. And it's evolved over a period of time. For me, it makes sense that I had to experience what a higher power could do for me before I believed in one. And, I mean, why should you believe in something else? You know, the tooth fairy is going to come take care of my problems or something. That's what I thought of it as. And I realized that for me, my early experience of what a higher power is just that calm I would feel about two-thirds of the way through a meeting. You know, my brain would slow down from 200 miles an hour to 100 miles an hour. And I would get that strange feeling that everything was going to be okay, even though it made me crazy to think about it. And I found out by talking to a sponsor, I get that feeling, a little bit of that feeling in between meetings. And then by doing the steps, I could have that feeling as long as I could. It'd last throughout the day, maybe. Or at least, you know, 5 minutes, which is a lot when I first got here. And I really thank that woman for getting me into, really getting me into the program, because I was so lost. I just was like a neonate in an intensive care unit. You know, I just wanted all Alan I could get, just full bore IVs, whatever. Just keep me going, you know. Because there's this way of Alan, a program thinking that it's like a template, a filter I use to see the world. And I knew there was an Alan way of doing things. I mean, if you ask enough people, you'll get someone who will agree with you, but most of the time answers are pretty consistent. Like if you say, I'm going to go drive around Jacksonville and look for my car, most people aren't going to say, yeah, let me get in my car, I'll help you. I'll help you do it. They're probably going to say something like, no, you see your sponsor, blah, 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 blah. My mama. Yeah. And I knew there was Al-Anon way of looking and stuff, and I just wanted to learn what that way was, because my way was not working anymore. And I didn't want it that way anymore. So I used to, you know, really listen to what people said, and also what they did. I try and find out this sort of magic way of looking at things. I don't think of myself as old, but I showed up at the, I rode my skateboard to the gym, and the lady working there said, I'm really glad when the seniors, I see senior citizens doing active stuff. Like, well, that's it. You know, so I went through stuff with that sponsor, and you know, I think about when I got the sponsor, I got him because I liked what he said in meetings, but also because he had a Navy flight jacket. And I see, I used to be in the Navy, and I had a flight jacket too, and I wanted to keep that. And he said, you're supposed to give them back. So I thought, well, if he could keep his flight jacket, he did the steps, and maybe if I get his sponsor, I won't have to do the flight jacket back. It shows you how spiritually deep I was in searching for that sponsor. I didn't have to get the jacket back, but I don't wear it anymore. That's the way things work in this program. To me, the spiritual solution is... the problem is removed. It's not necessarily the circumstances change, but the problem is removed. And I used to be really worried about self-esteem when I got here. I was obsessed with it. It was constantly plaguing me. And you know, after I did the steps for a while, I realized I wasn't thinking about it anymore. It wasn't that I felt great about myself. It's just it wasn't a problem. The problem was removed, like the problem with my girlfriend breaking up with me or not. You know, that problem got removed. And that's very different from my old way of doing things, which is to try and figure things out. And I thought if I just figured it out, I would get control over it and my life would run well. But to me, alcoholism can't be figured out. It just is. I had a big relief when I did my fifth step with my sponsor, a huge relief. I was on a pink cloud for a while. And I began to get a new fear. The new fear was doing the program wrong. Because I finally gotten some sanity, and I was not going to give it up. And I became deathly afraid of doing it wrong. Now I knew when I came here that step three meant I was going to be a missionary in Africa. Because I'd have to turn my life over. But after the fifth step, I started working on the 8 and 9. And I had my first Al-Anon crisis because my sponsor left town, so I got a new sponsor. And the new sponsor had all these weird ideas about the eighth step. You know, because I thought all these things I'd done were so terrible, and I was basically going to have to go to Leavenworth because I'd fudged on some travel claims and I had several government pens at home. And it's a rigorous honesty, you know. And that's what I thought. So, in between missionary and going to Leavenworth, I did my ninth step. I really thought I was going to have to the Inspector General and tell him, you know, look, I padded my travel claim for $5. But I was willing to do that. That was a scary thing to me. If that's what it took, if I was going to go to jail to get peace of mind, I was going to jail. I didn't care. Well, I cared, but I cared more about keeping my peace of mind. You know, my sponsor had me put down on a list of things that I had taken, just to make it simple for me. And, you know, some of the material stuff was easy enough to figure out, but I found out I'd taken some different things. I had taken a son away from my parents. I did that because I cut him off, you know. I'm just amazed when I hear people talk about it, say they're texting their child every day in college. I didn't call my parents except for one semester in college, and that was to ask for money. But I cut them out of my life as best I could. So I had to change stuff, and that's part of living amends that I had to make in this program, where I had to behave differently. I was very fortunate that in my spiritual struggle, people told me faith is an action, not a feeling. And, you know, so if I drive by her house to check on her, it means I don't have faith. It doesn't matter if I feel the presence of God in my heart or not. If I drive by her house, I'm not turning it over to him. So that made it easier for me. So I had an easier way of conceptualizing it. You know, it didn't matter. The feelings came later. That's what just happened in this program. I took the actions first, and the feelings came later. And that made it manageable for me, because I couldn't change the way that I felt, but I could change what I was doing. It was hard, but I could do that. When I got to the 11th step, you know, here I was, an atheist had on the 11th step, you know, but I wasn't an atheist anymore because I had an experience, you know. Once I did step 5, I started having an experience of God. It made me crazy to think about it, but I had a very elegant intellectual conception of the universe before I got here, but it just didn't work. It doesn't work for me. You got me chasing after the mailman, you know. That's I started this 11th step, and my sponsor told me it was a wide open space. He said, just explore, you know, search out what it means to you to have a God of your understanding. And, you know, that involved lots of literature and outside literature, too. Because there's a lot of good stuff out there, you know, and Al-Anon. Well, in the meetings, I don't talk about outside literature. Because, to me, it's an agreement. I have an agreement. I come to Al-Anon for a reason. That's to learn Al-Anon. It's not there's not a lot of great stuff out there, but it's just not what we're talking about at the time. So I started searching and praying. You know, I'm not someone who can sit down for more than a couple minutes at a time, usually. But I heard one speaker shared about going to Quaker meetings, Quaker services. And it was during those services, they're usually silent, unless someone feels moved to speak. So I go there and sit and learn how to meditate. So I did that for probably 5 or 6 years. And sometimes I still do go back to the meetings. They're very nice people. I did a 10-day silent Buddhist meditation retreat. You know, I just like go for everything all out. I don't mess around. I just go in for the gusto. I go for the overnight letters. But I did learn their method of meditation, and I continue to explore. I have a book study group on Mondays, which I invite anybody to. That we study all sorts of literature. It's not on me, but it's a good place to explore. And I guess I would want to say one more thing. It's about my relationship with my family. How much has it improved since I got here? And I have 3 sisters, and I always forget to say this, but my mother's sober now. She's been sober for over 30 years, and it's been fabulous. And she really is an incredible mother. And I'm very grateful to her. I didn't have any idea when she went into treatment. My sister called me and said, "Mom's in treatment." I said, "For what?" I didn't even know, you know. I knew she was crazy sometimes, but you know, I find out that when I stop trying to control my family and tell my sisters how to raise their kids and how to get along with their husbands and stuff, things got a lot better. It took a while, but I'm amazed that it turns out my sisters all have personalities. And they often have experience in many things that I don't have experience in. So sometimes I can actually get advice from them, you know. And I never heard that before because I was too busy knowing everything. I knew everything when I got here. I was crazy, but I knew everything. And at least I knew I was right. That's the most important thing for me, is to be right. And it made me crazy, and I said, "Do you want to be right or do you want to be happy?" Well, I said, "Well, I want to be right and happy." But it turns out I was wrong. You know, that's the greatest lesson I think Alan's taught me, is I'm wrong about life and so many things. I'm sane now, you know. I can go off the deep end pretty easily, but I have a place to come back to all the time, in my mind and physically and out on me. And it's a simple program, a stupid program, with this tooth fairy of a higher power. It doesn't make sense. I mean, it's anarchy. Once you let in that idea, you know, well, I could spend my day on a Ouija board or something, I don't know. But somehow it works, you know, and I've started to become the person I always wanted to be. Thank you.